You are listening to the Ivy Podcast. Learn from the thought leaders in areas of strategy, innovation, negotiation, and all things leadership. We interview the Ivy League, Fortune 100, and top startups. Now, here's your host, John Karsibayev.
Nick Sacco is OBHG's Chief Operating Officer, primarily responsible for client account management strategy. Through his strategic guidance and leadership to field operations team members, Nick focuses on hospital partners and the organization's changing business demands. He also oversees the enterprise process improvement efforts and lean management strategy. As a proven healthcare executive, Nick has extensive experience in physician practice management, metrics-based operations, talent development, and client relationship management. Nick joined OBHG in 2019, bringing nearly 20 years of experience working in healthcare, primarily with Envision Physician Services and Sheridan Healthcare. Welcome to the Ivy Podcast. Nick, thanks so much for finding time to join us on the Ivy Podcast. For our listeners, Nick and I have met during our time at Envision Healthcare. I want to say about 2 years ago. Feels like it's been forever.
I know.
So it's exciting to reconnect with you. I know you have a lot going on, so I'm excited about this episode for you to share with us all the things you've been doing. Can you just tell us a little bit more about your company, your role within the organization?
So I'm the COO of OB Hospitalist Group, OBHG as we call it. OBHG has been around for about 15 years. We are singularly focused on providing the country's really only true comprehensive OB hospitalist solution. An OB hospitalist is, kind of on paper, simply an OBGYN who works full-time in an inpatient and a hospital setting. We have over 900 clinicians who see about 500,000 patient encounters each year at our 180 hospital partners across 32 states. And why that's so important is, the U.S. has the highest maternal death rate amongst the world's developed nations. And from 2011 to 2015, the CDC completed a pretty exhaustive study and found that 3 out of 5 of those pregnancy-related deaths are preventable. And it went on to conclude that while there's really no single intervention that in and of itself is sufficient, one of the largest contributing factors is the lack of immediate access to a physician in the hospital that has sufficient experience with obstetric emergencies. That delay in care is a major driver of not only serious harm events, but by itself contributes to a third of the OB medical malpractice claims in the country. And so having an OB hospitalist in the house 24/7, ready to respond, is key to cutting out that delay, delay in care. And the result really has been pretty impressive. And so if you look at OBHG programs over the past 15 years, there is a 30% reduction in perinatal serious harm events compared to hospitals that don't have an OBHG program. 75% fewer births resulting in malpractice claims. And then when a claim does happen and a payout occurs, because of the documentation, because of the work that the OB hospitals contributed, the actual payout is 35% lower for OBHG partner hospitals than the national average. So really just, kind of impressive life-saving work that our physicians and our allied health providers are doing every day.
Wow, those are some impressive statistics that you're sharing with us. A lot of that I had no idea.
Yeah, not a lot of people
do. Stats are pretty scary, actually.
They are.
Wow. So you as, you lead the kind of the entire operations of the company. Can you share with us a little bit more in terms of practical recommendations when it comes to, there's a good portion of our listeners are executives from different organizations. And it's good to hear different perspective of how other executives lead their enterprise organization during unprecedented times as COVID. What has been some of the lessons learned or some of the discoveries for you through this period so far?
Yeah, you know, I think the first, second, and third best thing we did with our entire workforce is communicate. And you know, when I say communicate, really two-way, because listening was, you know, as important, if not more important, especially during sort of the early stages of the acute phase of COVID. And so, you know, as we made decisions, as we, you know, had information to share, we cascaded those down, and also the reasoning behind, you know, the decisions we made through the entire organization. After about the third week of kind of the shift to full remote work, our CEO and our CMO put together a weekly internal podcast, and they had, you know, not only addressed issues that were kind of current that week, but had guests on throughout the entire organization, clinical and non-clinical, and really opened themselves up to a non-scripted, you know, a bilateral communication. Which was just absolutely, you know, I think paramount to our ability to keep engaging with our employees at a tough time. You know, also, you know, our ability to listen and respond, particularly to our clinical community, was important. You know, I can, the one that stands out for me is very early on, you know, OB hospitalists are shift workers. And so, you know, if they opt to not work on a shift, they don't get paid. And that's typically a great, you know, kind of a flexible feature of our model. In this case, there was a lot of concern that, hey, if I have a workplace exposure to COVID and I go into a, you know, a mandatory imposed quarantine, what happens? And, you know, that's something, obviously, we just were not prepared for, you know, an issue like that to hit us across the country. And so we very quickly responded to that and stood up a fund for our employees who would be impacted and make sure that they didn't have to worry about, you know, kind of the continuation of their own personal income.
Non-scripted is what really stood out to me as you were talking through. It's, I think it's so important because, you know, it seems so simple yet very powerful when it comes to, you know, that transparency, that communication, especially through times like this. And kind of, you nailed it on the head, you know, labeling that as non-scripted being something very genuine. I think that's very important and resonates, I'm pretty sure, with everyone within the organization. So with so many companies going through layoffs, furloughs, downsizing, all the unfortunate, you know, impact through these times, what has worked well for you when it comes to some of the kind of employee motivation strategies through this period?
Yeah, I think, you know, kind of in line with the communication is, you know, early on we developed COVID-specific metrics that, you know, informed our decisions on things like downsizing, furloughs, other cost containment measures. We gained buy-in into those metrics with the leadership team. And then we kept our teams updated on exactly how those measures were tracking. You know, and we made sure that they, you know, as we, I'll give you a great example, our new business development dried up obviously pretty quickly as hospitals who we sell into just had no bandwidth for anything other than COVID. And so we made sure that our teams had insight into kind of the upstream dry up of that business development pipeline. And so I think that was really just critical in making sure our team members understood the logic behind some of the cost containment measures we took. You know, I think the other was encouraging the teams to look for the opportunities created by the crisis, the good and the bad. You know, the inability to travel meant a chance to engage with one another and with our clients at all levels of the organization around a common threat. How do we kind of pivot and add value to one another and to our clients in that setting? The new growth, like I said, coming to a halt, that was an opportunity to focus on stabilizing the core business. So really encourage the teams to not fixate on the things that we can't change, but to kind of embrace the opportunities that were, you know, made available to us because of, you know, the crisis.
Love what you've mentioned in terms of looking more at, you know, the opportunities that are presented through this period rather than how do we react and almost, you know, kind of different strategies to adapt to this period. So I think those are, you know, very interesting strategies that you're sharing with us. So thank you for that.
Yeah,
to shift focus a little bit from, you know, the COVID and all the kind of that that negative, so to say, topic, which is still important. Curious, you've been in healthcare for quite some time. Obviously, you do a lot of research and analysis on any trends that are coming up. From healthcare standpoint, what do you foresee will come out as a result of current times in terms of that next healthcare trend?
Yeah, you know, I think in the physician space that we're in, you know, the obvious is telehealth. You know, I think it was a sort of fledgling field and you know, before COVID, and it really does need to kind of make its way into mainstream healthcare delivery. And so as you look at the relaxation of the rules from CMS, you know, kind of combine that with a significantly increased user adoption rate due to COVID, it creates a perfect storm for telemedicine that, you know, I think will be tough for the states and for the federal government to fully roll back. And I think that's nothing but a good story for, you know, all of us as end users of the healthcare system. And, you know, you think about, you know, some of these more rural areas in the country, even if a hospital is able to afford recruiting a much needed physician, the ability to find those individuals in a lot of subspecialties is really just not there. And so, you know, to virtually take the brain power from somebody from a major metropolitan area like Houston, Los Angeles, Chicago, and insert that experience and that skill set into the rural areas of our country, I think is going to be something that's absolutely going to be prevalent over the next, you know, kind of 5 years or so. You know, the other I think will be inevitable is further consolidation on both the hospital side and on the community physician practice side. I think there were a lot of small and medium hospitals that had flirted with the idea of you know, being acquired by a national partner that said, hey, we made the decision to kind of go it alone. I think COVID presents, you know, now the challenge of, is that really something that we can do going forward, or do we need a partner like that to survive? And I think the same things, you know, if you think about the community physician side, there are a lot of community practices who are impacted severely by this and might need a national partner just to kind of get back to normal, to recover. I think the third thing is that I'm kind of on the fence, and I'm admittedly by no means an expert on value-based care. Mm. You know, I think we'll see some impact on value-based care. If you kind of read what's out there, people are on the fence. You know, I think the population has realized more than ever that we need to do something about the way we deliver healthcare in this country. You know, I think the rub is that COVID proved that you can throw predictability out the window at this point. And so, you know, if we were in, you know, a fully realized value-based care setting, what would the impact have been to physicians and hospitals? And so I think that makes a lot of people nervous. So there will be an impact, I think, on value-based care, but it's really murky right now for me to predict what that will be.
Right. It's funny you mentioned some of these aspects, like number one, telehealth and telemedicine. I recently hosted two CEOs of two community health centers here in Florida on a virtual panel. And, you know, the topic of that webinar was all around telehealth, e-health, connected health. And it was just, you know, very, you know, refreshing to hear a lot of the strategies that they implement at their practices. So I can definitely relate to what you're talking about, that really, that being the next trend. The other part is kind of that value-based care, you know, versus the volume-based. It's, you know, I spent some time with Chief Medical Officer ChenMed, Dr. Gordon Chen, and, you know, they're so much into kind of that whole concept of value-based care, really focusing on kind of those predictive, you know, measures rather than something that's already occurred. I think that's very interesting space that's, you know, slowly gaining ground, and I see a lot of potential there as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
When it comes to innovation, especially during current times where, like, if we look at like Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you know, at the lowest level, it's all about kind of that safety, survival. You can't really focus or think about, you know, innovation per se. Curious from your standpoint, kind of what methodologies or any tools or strategies that you have deployed that consistently help you come up with some innovative ways to solve certain problems for the services that you guys provide?
Yeah, so I, you know, no gems, unfortunately, of innovative wisdom coming from me, unfortunately. You know, I think we're focused right now, one, on how to capitalize on some of the trends that we've just talked about. You know, how do we, with, you know, as one of the nation's largest providers of OBGYN services, how do we, you know, kind of bring that to bear in thinking about our new strategic frontiers? But I think just as important right now, you know, kind of going back to your analogy, I want to think that we're at least one rung above food, water, shelter. We're really focused on how to speak about our business, how we show up differently in the new world we find ourselves in. We need to make sure we're able to continue to demonstrate OBHG's unique value prop in the face of, you know, the current challenges. You know, we've got, you know, more selling of our services being done remotely, obviously. And then we've got prospective hospital partners who are trying to financially recover from the impact while simultaneously, you know, planning for an uncertain potential second wave. And so, you know, how do we, you know, as senior leaders, empower our team members to really focus on representing the core business in a new way that, you know, will still resonate with clients that are in a different dynamic now?
Right, absolutely. When it comes to hiring or, you know, attracting the top talent to your organization, can you share with us a little bit more in terms of what strategies do you deploy to attract the top talent? And as much, I guess, as you can share, tell us a little bit more about what does the interview process look like if the, you know, candidate is interviewing either with you or, you know, with someone within your organization?
Yeah, you know, I wouldn't say, you know, we get too creative in the process, but I will tell you that I look for attitude, intellectual horsepower, and experience really in that order. You know, it's healthcare, and you can find a lot of people who've got, you know, 20, 30 years of really impressive experience on paperwork. You know, I want folks that are going to show up, you know, with that positive energy, the desire to really get out there and be scrappy, you know, in a positive way with our hospital partners. And then I want them to know that they're going to bring, you know, sort of the strategic mind to bear to solve problems, both operationally and the problem solvers for our partners, because that's how you really sort of add value to hospitals. I don't want folks that are maybe experts at keeping the trains, you know, running on time, but really, you know, can't be creative thinkers, creative problem solvers for hospitals. And so, you know, I don't, like I said, nothing too creative, but that's what we kind of focus on when we think about bringing talent into, you know, at least the operations, you know, the team here at OBHG.
And what are some of the kind of the most in-demand skill set that you guys are currently experiencing, those that are the hardest to find?
You know, I think the hardest to find are clinicians that join the company with solid pre-existing leadership experience. It's really rare, especially in the OBGYN field, you know, as we sort of, you know, trailblaze this subspecialty of women's care. And yet the role of a program, of a site medical director, is absolutely pivotal to the execution of our mission. And so, you know, kind of in line with, you know, what we talked about, you know, before, you know, we really look for physicians who have the ability and the willingness, sort of the right clay, that our seasoned regional medical directors can then mold into a strong clinical leader. And so, you know, if you think about, you know, all of all the hands that touch a OBHG client every day, there is only, you know, really one leader, and that's the medical director, who is there consistently, you know, each month delivering the service at the patient level. And so you can have, you know, this big, robust, supportive organization, but if you've got, you know, a insufficient leader in that role, then you're just not going to be able to execute on the mission the way we need to.
Yeah, and it's also, you know, it sounds like kind of that technical domain expertise in particular areas is very important, but also the kind of those soft skills that really go along with that ability, you know, to lead, adapt, emotional intelligence, a lot of those things that a lot of different industries are experiencing in terms of that, really finding that right combination, that really perfect candidate. Last but not least, Nick, what are you currently reading and which book do you always recommend to others and why?
Yeah, so I'm currently reading a book that has nothing to do about leadership. It's called You Never Forget Your First. It's a biography on George Washington, written from a completely different perspective, the perspective of kind of his personal life before he became the founding father and commander-in-chief leader that we know, and all the things that happened to him in his childhood and young adulthood to mold him into that person that we needed. So great book, by the way. I recommend it. I'm about halfway through. The book that I always recommend, I'm a big Marshall Goldsmith fan, and so my go-to recommendation, you know, still for years has been the book What Got You Here Won't Get You There. I love that book. I refer back to it often, and you know, if there was kind of, you know, one book that I look at and say that was, you know, for me really really beneficial in my development as a leader, it would be that one.
Oh, that's awesome! Thank you for sharing that. We'll make the title and authors of these books available in the episode notes. Nick, thank you so much for finding time to talk to us. A lot of great insights, a lot of, you know, I personally learned quite a bit from this conversation. Definitely, you know, let's stay in touch. And thank you for making the time to talk to us today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on, John.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.